Today's episode of the Our Hen House podcast is being sponsored by our partner, A Well-Fed World. A Well-Fed World is a hunger relief and animal protection organization chipping away at two of the world's most immense, unnecessary, and unconscionable forms of suffering. The suffering of people hungry from lack of food and the suffering of animals used and abused for food. Mending our unjust food system is a critical part of solving the world's most destructive and persistent problems. Fortunately, the plant-based foods that promote health and well-being are the same foods that conserve resources to better feed the world while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and protecting the environment. A well-fed world provides the means for change by empowering individuals, social justice organizations, and political decision-makers to embrace the benefits of plant-based foods and farming. Learn more at awfw.org.
Our hen house is a squawking house. Our hen house is their hen house. Our hen house, ooh, it's a funky fresh house. Our hen house is your hen house.
Hello and welcome to Our Hen House. This is Marianne Sullivan, and I really believe the show is going to bring you the inspiration that you probably desperately need right now. We all desperately need some inspiration. I will be joined by Mark Ching, who is doing really unbelievable work fighting the dog meat trade in Asia. You are not going to want to miss this interview. And Jasmine will be talking to Ben Friedland, who took his company from one that makes bags out of exotic skins and leather to a totally vegan brand. And that's the kind of progress we all need to hear about right now. And, of course, the election has passed. It's over after this year of hell. It is over, and there may be a few of you listening who are Trump supporters. I don't know. I really honestly don't know. And you probably won't understand how I feel if you are out there, but I imagine a lot of you know how hard this is because you're probably going through the exact same thing that I am. And the thing I keep holding on to, that I keep desperately trying to hold on to, is that I cannot let despair take hold as much as it is closing in on me, and I admit it is closing in on me, but I am an activist, and I am so proud of wearing that label right at this particular moment. And I've really been inspired so much by some of the people who have shown up on my Facebook feed who are also activists and who have responded to what, you know, is really a devastating disappointment for so many people, not with despair, but just by figuring out what comes next. And the animals don't have time for us to despair, that's for sure. They live in conditions of utter despair and misery. We have to remember that no matter who got elected, that was going to continue. Our work has to continue. The world still doesn't really understand where we're coming from. And nobody who's running for office, except for a very few people, really get it at all. So our work is cut out for us. And as I said, we just don't have time for despair. So I was inspired by stuff that showed up in my Facebook feed. And I thought maybe I'd read a few of them or parts of them in hopes that they'll inspire you as much as they inspired me. They're not necessarily specifically or just about animals. They're just about being an activist. And, you know, if you start hanging around with people for one reason or another, your job or whatever, who really don't have any kind of activism on their radar, like, you just wonder, like, why? Why, if you see injustice, if you see something wrong, would you not want to spend your time? I mean, of course, we can't spend all of our time. We have to make a living or whatever. But why would you not want to fix it? Like, isn't that what life is about, to strive to make things better? I don't know. But anyway, I'm going to read a few of these. This first one is from John Lovern, who is the head of litigation at HSUS. And he posted this. This is the first thing I saw on the morning after the election. Oh, fuck this and fuck despair. This is why I went to law school and why we have courts. I will not go quietly into the night. I have the honor of being part of the largest and most effective legal fighting force for animals ever assembled in the history of our movement. We will not let some maniac dismantle the last decade of progress, and my counterparts in other social movements won't either. We will block him at every turn. Every inch will be contested. Nothing will be conceded. pleaded. Hundreds of federal judges woke up today just as terrified and angry as the rest of us. I'll see your racist, misogynist, animal-hating ass in court, Donald. You are about to get schooled in just how limited presidential power really is under the Constitution of the United States of America. I almost get chills just reading it. And here's another one from Camille Labchuk, who's from Animal Justice in Canada. A reminder that this election is just as devastating for people who were not eligible to vote in it because they're from other countries. But, you know, we're talking about America. Like, you know, we're an important force in the world. We're a hugely, hugely important force in the world. I won't read all of Camille's posts, but I just want to add this part because I think it's so relevant to what I'm talking about. All I want to do today is wallow in despair. But better still, to fight. If we have any hope of stopping some of the worst pain Trump wants to inflict, this fight needs every single one of us, and not just those who live in America. So please, become an activist. Give your voice, give your volunteer hours, and give your financial support to the fight against the nightmare we all woke up to this morning. Jaya Bumitra from Animal Equality. And this is what she had to say. I started this morning too depressed to get out of bed, but I forced myself to and went to the gym and ran. With each step, I grew stronger. Fuck Trump. I'm still with her. I'm with all women, immigrants, the disabled, people of color, the LGBT community, animals, the environment, and every other underrepresented and oppressed group who has had to bear bullying, intimidation, colonization, and authoritarianism for all our lives. I have the fight back now. I'm an activist. I'll see you on the front lines. Really good, right? You know, it was just such a relief to read this stuff. Finally, here's something from Jay Schuster, who's at NYU. Stay strong. This is not how the story ends. I have no doubt that if everyone harnesses the profound fear and sadness and anger that they are feeling right now and commits to using this energy every single day hereafter, we will be unstoppable. Seriously, write it down. We are at war against racism and sexism and classism and speciesism and homophobia and Islamophobia and xenophobia, and I will live every day like the fate of the world is at stake, because it is. And it really is. You know, it really is. No matter, you know, and I said, like, in the beginning, maybe some of you supported Trump. You know, obviously, those of us on each side of this divide do not get the other side at all. And, you know, I admit it. I don't get it. But if that's where you're coming from, the animals are still desperate. The animals are going to be more desperate. This is not going to be an administration that cares about animals. I mean, that's really clear. So we all have our work cut out for us. And also keep in mind, it's helpful that, you know, we had a few animal protection initiatives on the ballot, and they were unbelievably successful. That's got to give you a little hope. The Massachusetts Ballot Initiative, which we've talked about many times on the show, and which, you know, not only will eliminate the battery cage, the gestation crate, and the veal crate, but will also ban the sale of quote-unquote food that is derived from animals kept prisoner in these systems. It won by a huge margin. Huge. And there was a huge campaign against it from the industry. They did not go quietly into this. So they fought it tooth and nail. And not even close. And also in Oklahoma, we've talked also about the Right to Farm initiative that was on the ballot there, which would have removed from the legislature the power to regulate farms in many ways, including vis-a-vis animal welfare. And it also lost by a substantial margin in Oklahoma. So that's very inspiring. This isn't exactly an initiative, but Jamie Raskin, who is an ethical vegan, was elected to Congress from Maryland. That's pretty cool. You know, I wonder if there's even more vegans in Congress. Who knows? Not everybody would announce it. But he not only is vegan, I mean, he's vegan for his health as well, but, you know, he's not shy about saying that it's for the ethics that he cares. So that's cool. Also, not directly relevant, but marijuana is not illegal in a lot more places than it was. I'm not sure that's animal news, but it might be of interest to some of you who are extremely stressed out. And by the way, I should point out that much of this podcast that is to follow was recorded prior to the election. So if the tone seems a bit mixed or a little off, don't be too surprised. But You know, as it so happens, our first interview today actually couldn't be more perfect. And Mark Ching, who is going to be up next, is an activist who really does keep going in the face of almost unimaginable adversity. Nothing that we face is what he has seen on a day-to-day basis doing his work. Mark started as an herbalist and holistic nutritionist, and he's the owner of the Petstaurant in Los Angeles. And there he makes what he calls species-appropriate meals for both dogs and cats. And he also founded Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation. He founded it about 5 years ago, and he wanted to rescue and rehabilitate severely abused animals locally in Los Angeles. And then he expanded his mission, and now he is most well-known within the animal protection movement for the work that he started just last year when he took on another cause, that is conquering the dog meat trade in Asia. And he will be joining me right after this.
Our Hen House has a family of podcasts. In addition to the Our Hen House podcast, which you're listening to right now, you can also listen to the Animal Law podcast or the Teaching Jasmine How to Cook Vegan podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, and what's not to like, please leave us a friendly review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us tremendously, because that's how we grow, and that's how we reach more and more people with information on how to change the world for animals. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to our Hen House, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. You're doing such unbelievable work. And I honestly don't know how you do what you do. But and, you know, I thought we'd start with your start, at least regard not your start caring about animals, but your start of involvement in the dog trade. Can you walk us through the first time you learned firsthand what was happening in the dog meat trade?
My foray into Asia to document what was going on out there, it started last year in September. However, it kind of started preceding months before that. I started to see these images and these mild videos on top of Facebook and social media about this thing called the Yulin Dog Meat Festival. And when I saw it, I actually thought it was fake. But I saw so much of it, you know, I was like, wow, to me, it just had to be fake. And so I kind of left to see if it was true, just because sometimes I'm untrusting of the media. And when I went to Asia, I found out it's true, and it's a lot more graphic and severe than people think.
I know that what happens there is really horrible, and it's probably hard to talk about, much less to have seen. And our audience is already sensitive to these very issues, so I want to keep that in mind. But give us an idea of the kind of things you saw at Yulin.
At Yulin, so I kind of want to explain things. In America and the Western societies, a lot of people are fixated on this festival, which is horrific. But Yulin is a compilation of a few days where all these people in China come and they torture dogs, you know, and they eat them and they celebrate kind of like dog meat and the way they process them, things like that. And so when you go to Yulin, you see hangings, beatings, things like that. It's pretty graphic. However, if you look at the dog meat trade as a whole, you know, in Cambodia or different parts of China, it's more extreme there than what they're doing in Yulin. And so that's kind of what we do. We document the entire dog meat trade to show consistency that in all these countries, dogs are tortured for their meat because they believe, you know, there's a medicinal or a health benefit through that. And so.
And what, I mean, I've heard a little bit about this, but maybe not all of our audience has. What is the relationship between the particularly gruesome things that happen to these animals and their use, as you said, as this sort of medicinal food?
Well, they vary by region, and even in China, because China is so large, if you look at the regions and provinces in China, their belief is a little different, but the consistency over the whole Asian kind of like realm is this, that if you abuse a dog and torture them before you eat them, a few things. One is it has healing effects for your body. Two, the adrenaline release tenderizes the meat. Three, it's kind of that Viking principle where in the olden days war, where they killed like the leader and then they ate their heart and so it gave them that strength. So they believe if the dog endures this type of suffering, then if you ingest the meat, it makes you stronger as well. In some regions, they even take out the bile of the dogs and use that for medicine. In Indonesia, they told me they've proven that if they beat the dog this way, skin them alive, that when you eat the meat, if you have things like cancer, things like that, you know, it can cure your body. And in some places, they think that the meat cools you down in hot temperatures or raises your temperature when it's very cold. And then the last thing is kind of like male sexual virility. And so those are the things that I've been told from people within the regions.
And how widespread is it?
I'm sure it's more widespread than even I think, but the countries I've been to China, I mean all over China, Mongolia, South Korea, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Philippines, Indonesia, and Indonesia is this network of islands, and so I've been to many, many islands, and I've also been to Laos, and so those are the places that I've gone to document things, and each country, you know, there's a scale of how cruel it is, where Vietnam to me is a 2, Korea is like a 3 to a 4, China is from a 5 to an 8, you know, a place like Indonesia, very, very, very cruel, and 8, and where, in my opinion, Cambodia is where you see the worst types of torture. And so, but it's all over those places, but I'm sure in places I've never been as well.
Is it particularly segments of the population? Are these in particularly rural areas, traditional areas? Does it run the gamut from all income levels?
A lot of people don't realize that dog meat is not a cheap meat. So in Cambodia, where the population is generally very, very poor, you know, they only have a like uber super rich class, and then, you know, 90% of the whole population of the country is poor. Dog meat is a delicacy, and so it's more expensive than steak. It's more expensive. It's the most expensive type of meat. In saying that, all you need is a small piece of dog meat because they usually make soups out of it. And so if you're drinking that soup or partaking in that, then that's the kind of health benefit you get through, I guess, the food, according to them.
Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship is there with dogs generally? I mean, I know you're talking about a huge area of the world, and people vary tremendously in their attitudes towards dogs. But generalizing a bit, what kind of relationships are there with dogs? Do people have their own pet dogs and then other dogs are raised for food? Is it very separate, or are there areas where dogs are really not favorite animals at all?
Well, all of the above. And so, like, you know, especially, so I'll talk about South Korea. South Korea, they have dog meat farms. They have a dog farmers association where they raise dogs to be killed. In this country, the growing population of dog owners, it's vast and it's booming. And, you know, it's like this new industry out there where, you know, the Malteses, French Bulldogs, they have clothes on, stuff like that. And so this place in this country, they love their dogs. And then there's a segment that eats dogs even though they own dogs. And so those people kind of say, well, those are meat dogs, are meant to be eaten, and these dogs are pets. They kind of don't look at it like how another person would. But hence, you know, some people who look at dogs don't equate the same thing to a pig. So I guess it's that same mentality in that country. In regions like Cambodia, where the pet ownership is pretty low, you still see people, because I've interviewed them, people who view their pets as family members. They sleep on their bed. They take them to vets. They try to feed them the best as possible. When they're hurt, they feel hurt too, stuff like that. And then, you know, there's regions in Indonesia where dogs are considered, you know, vile scum of the earth. And so they don't even eat them. They just butcher them when they see them running around. They'll smash their heads and cut their feet off, throw them against the wall, stuff like that. And so throughout Asia, you see in all different places a collection or just like a gamut of different attitudes towards dogs as a whole.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously a lot of those involve disconnects, but people manage to create a lot of disconnects
in their thinking when it comes to animals, so that's not surprising. Is there any governmental action regarding dog eating or dog farming or dog killing?
You know, it's pretty amazing. And so I just, I've taken these 9 huge trips to all these different countries. They're usually a collection of countries, and I go documenting. I go undercover to document as a dog meat buyer. I just recently went to the Philippines, and I went to the Philippines because a few years ago they passed an anti-cruelty law. Why? It's because Philippines is a large dog-eating country. There were so many reports of stolen pets because actually dog ownership is very high there. And so they passed an anti-cruelty law about 2.5 to 3 years ago, and I went there to see, because that's one of the only countries I know that has a law like that. So I went to see the strength of the law, how it's changed the industry. This law has been so powerful that people are scared to butcher a dog because you will go to prison, you know? And so like in a country like that, they set kind of like the precedence for, it is possible if you put laws in place. In China, where they take, I think, the most criticism, it doesn't look like much is changing. It just doesn't. And so will it? I believe so, but has it? Very little.
So what about your investigations, and can you tell us a bit about some of the dangers involved in investigating this industry?
Well, so, you know, when I started doing this, I started a single rescue. I went out to Asia and I saw the desperation of these dogs being tortured. And at that point, for my first 2 or 3 trips, I used to buy dogs because I didn't know what else to do. On my 4th trip, or at the end of my 3rd trip and then my 4th trip on, I started going undercover. I had gotten beat up pretty bad. And so when I did, you know, a light kind of popped in and says, like, look, if you're going to do this, be effective, first of all. You know, rescuing 20 dogs or something like that, it's not going to change much in the end. However, it does, it changes so much for that life. But I figured that I'd die in the long run if I don't do something smarter. And so we created this cover where I go undercover as a dog meat buyer, and I document what they're doing to try to show the government of that country, this is what they're doing, this is how they're torturing these dogs in this region, this is their style, stuff like that. The dangers, you know, I've been to way over 100 slaughterhouses, and I've only been assaulted or beat up 6 times. And so, you know, one time was severe when I had to go to the hospital. And so is it dangerous? I mean, it can be. You know, it can be. Especially in China, where I think it's the most dangerous. The pressure, the media pressure is so large that these people, and I can't really tell you why they're so upset, but sometimes I think it's because they think you're trying to destroy their livelihood. And so when you come in, especially if they find out that you're undercover, which few ever do, there's this intense or heated battle. And so
how do you pass as a local buyer coming from America?
Well, it's much easier than you think. So, you know, this is the best thing that I have going is that an Asian.
Well, that gives you a little bit of an edge.
Correct. But not only that, I don't speak the language, and so I hire a translator, and we always get a local guide. And usually the locals know everybody. And you know, we tell them, you know, my dog meat buyer in this industry, this is what I want to do. I'm the largest importer to America. I'd like you to get me into these places. And so it's a work in progress. We don't get into every place, but we're pretty good to where we get into a lot of places. You see, and so I know the jargon so well, or just what they do. So we come in and we say, look, you know, or my translator says, you know, my client wants to buy 5,000 kilograms of dog a week. You see, is this something you can do? And if it is, he says, you know, he'd like to see the style, the processing, how you do it, your facility. And, you know, that's kind of like the structure of what we do. And when I go inside, everything's taken on my iPhone, and I just have the video on and I walk through, and it's they're just doing whatever they do as a job, and I try to document best as I can.
Wow. Yeah. It just sounds unbelievable. You also still managed to get dogs out, right?
Correct. If you look at the amount of places I go to, the amount of dogs we've actually rescued is very little. Why is because, especially now, because we don't buy dogs anymore. And so at the end of whenever I'm about to leave, you know, there'll be 40 dogs still alive that have been beaten up, tortured, waiting to be processed, that are just on the ground. A lot of them have been what's called put into hot water to where it loosens their fur. Some of them have just been hung and stunned. They beat them in the face. They beat them in the body to stun them. And then, you know, it continues. And when I leave, we ask to try the meat. Some places say no. Some places say yes. And so we ask them, well, can we take these three dogs as a sample to see, you know, how great your meat is from the way you process your dogs. And so that's our typical way to get dogs now. However, you know, I think the most popular thing we did was in Yulin, I temporarily shut down these slaughterhouses. You know, and in doing so, we had all these dogs. That is separate from what I usually do, where I go undercover and I try to get dogs for free as samples.
So how did you pull that off?
Well, the temporary closures, the whole thing about Yulin was to do something different. Every year, people sign petitions or, you know, they do protests. And every year, the festival happens and it's terrible and, you know, to me, nothing changes. And so this year, or this past year, I thought, how can we make it different? And I felt if I went in and I cut the supply of dogs, when you went in, it would be harder to find what you're looking for. And so a month prior, I think it was 5 weeks prior, I went to Yulin and I met all these slaughterhouse owners. And I tried to structure a deal and I said, look, how much money do you make in a day? And it would be like $500 American or whatever during the Yulin Dog Meat Festival. I said, let me pay you that. You shut down. You don't have to pay your workers. And that's it, you know, for the entire festival. And so those are the deals we tried to put together. What happened, what I didn't anticipate, was when you go to something like that, they have thousands of dogs. And so the places that we shut down these places, you know, we couldn't leave the dogs to be tortured and killed after. And so we had to take them. And so we ended up with all these dogs and the aftercare. And it's just been, it's been hard, but, you know, it's, you manage and you make do. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I really want to talk about the dogs that you rescue and what you do to help them out. But first, I want to talk about what's going on with you. You know, all of us involved in animal rights try to find a balance between knowing about what's happening and not getting overwhelmed by it. And you really know what's happening. You know really, really horrible things, and you've seen them. You've seen them up close. You've had to be fake when you saw them, you know, to get through, to protect your own safety and to accomplish what you wanted to do. What do you do to take care of yourself doing this kind of work, and also to not burn out, to not say, no, I cannot do this anymore?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to be honest. You know, I'm not well, and so I don't take care of myself, and, like, I don't have the answer to that, you know. You know, one time I met with this guy from National for Animals, and this was on trip 4, before I left for trip 4, and he had told me, you know, Mark, you don't realize this, but you're going to kill yourself doing what you're doing. And you have to learn how to separate yourself from the dog and look at what they're doing as like an empty glass. And 5 trips later, which is my 9th trip, I haven't been able to accomplish that. And so, I don't know. I can't even tell you how.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine this wouldn't cause a certain amount of post-traumatic stress disorder.
I don't even know what it is. You know, I don't know what PTSD means. I mean, like, just like, I didn't know what torture meant. You know, when you look at a word, you never understand what it means in the beginning. Now, it is clear what torture is. I fully understand the word, you know, and whatever I'm going through, I can't even explain it. It's ruined my life. I mean, like, before when I came back on trips, I would have my children, have these 2 young children. And no matter how hard it was or what I had to see, whenever I saw them, it kind of made it okay. Like, okay, you're doing it for them. But then over time, that doesn't become what you need anymore. So how, I don't even know. But at the end of the day, I tell myself one thing, which I think many animal activists say, is that those animals that are dying, whatever I'm going through cannot even compare to the horrors that they experience. And if they live through it and die with dignity, at least I can. And I think that's how we do it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people who really go through traumatic situations with animals do say to themselves. But I mean, clearly, there are times that we have to draw lines and seek help. And I think that what you go through is clearly devastating. And the real point, as an animal activist, is to be able to keep doing it or keep doing something to, as Henry Speer used to say, push the peanut forward to make what change we can. And I, you know, I'm worried about you, Mark. I really am. I mean, I can see that this affects you deeply. Let's talk a little bit about the effect on the animals, because as you said, that's the thing that kind of motivates you, even though it's, you know, maybe not enough to protect you. But when you bring these animals out and you save them, what kind of challenges do they have? What kind of condition are they in, both physically and emotionally?
Mostly, I rescue torture victims. You know, when you go into a slaughterhouse, you know, there might be 2,000 dogs, there might be 50, you know. Some of them are in cages waiting to be killed. Some of them are dead on the ground. Some of them are being tortured. And so, like, you know, when I leave and I try to rescue whoever they allow me to, I take those that need the help, the ones that have been hung. I take the ones that are missing legs, that are still alive, ones that have been boiled alive. The challenges these dogs face, I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, of 100 dogs, it might be 22 survivors, 10 survivors. I mean, like, you know, the survivor rate isn't high many times. And so sometimes people ask me, why would you rescue a dog like that? But we rescue a dog like that because their lives have been so terrible that if they make it, if they survive, you know, the gift of what awaits them is so huge. You know, most of these dogs we bring to America, all torture cases actually we bring back. You know, if we shut down a farm, something, we try to adopt some of those dogs locally to spread awareness, and then we bring a bunch of them back as well. But the torture victims come to America, and they come here because the one promise I give them is that you'll sleep on a bed or you'll have this, or like, and I just look at it like, I don't know, if you can make it, there's a dream waiting, you know, something you could have never imagined. What's so amazing is that even after someone cut your feet off, you can come and you can love and you can move forward. Human beings cannot do that. And I don't know if, I don't understand why we cannot, but they can. And so if you look at it, animals can teach us so much about life, how to love each other, how to be more compassionate. And so, yeah.
Who are some of the animals that you currently have looking for homes?
I have a dog. Well, we have a victims adoption program where some of our torture victims go to rape victims so that they can heal each other. I have this dog in my house named Liberty. We call her Rosie Flowers because my daughter calls her that. She has no front feet, and so she was a torture case, hung, beaten. She's going to go into our victims adoption program, but you know, the amount of awareness she's going to raise through who she is and her story, it's going to be huge, you know. But outside of that, I mean, we have a dog named Shadow who was hung and tortured. And so I have the processing video. And we have this dog named Glory, bound, beat with a pipe. They suffocated her in a bag. And I can't even believe she survived. Like, if you see, like, the vet video, it's like, you look at that, it's like, how is this dog going to make it? But some of them do, and it's just miraculous.
And tell me a little bit more about the victim adoption program.
So in our victim adoptions program, we look for severe cases where people have openly said, like, you know, I'm suicidal. This guy raped me or did something to me that ruined my life. And then we, you know, I meet with these people and I talk to them and I try to show them, like, look, give me a chance. Let me help you. You know, I know a lot of people say that and a lot of people want to talk to you or have you talk about your issues. I don't want none of that. I just want you to live with this dog for a little while and let me tell you this dog's story. You know, this dog, you know, we have sodomy cases that are local in LA, stuff like that. And I'll tell them, you know, this dog was tortured, hung, beat. This dog was raped. And together, maybe you'll move forward. You'll be able to look at another living thing and say, like, wow, you endured so much, but still you've grown to trust me, someone who's endured so much as well. And in the program, it's been highly, highly successful. I mean, these dogs have helped people to keep them from killing themselves. And so, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah, that's a beautiful idea. And I'm really pleased to hear that you have had successes with it. You know, I know that so many people who care about the dog issue and care about the dog eating issue still are not worried about eating, you know, who else they're eating. But that's not true of you. How did you first make the connection between dogs and other animals killed for food?
I've been a vegan, not my whole life. You know, like I assume you or other people or the world, you know, we learn. As we're educated and our consciousness grows, we learn. I've only been a vegan, I think, for maybe 2 years. It started with this dog named Gumby. This was before I started doing the Asia dog meat trade. But I rescued this torture case, and so part of my job was to map out and pay all these specialists who charge injuries so they could prosecute somebody. Man, this dog was tortured so brutally. And it was weird, like, you know, just so you know, it was the biggest carnivore. You know, I was a steak guy, a bacon guy. But it was weird, like, I was driving him one day after work, driving to meet his adopted parents in Petaluma. So the drive was about 6 hours. And he was with me, sat on my lap. And his dog was so messed up, someone took his eyeball out, broke all his ribs, smashed his foot so many times, kicked his jaw open so his mouth was crooked, ripped his teeth out. I mean, it's just crazy. And while I was on this drive with him, I don't know, I just saw my children, and it was weird. And so from that point, I kind of made the connection to other animals. However, it wasn't until I walked into a dog slaughterhouse that I understood what being vegan was. To relate a dog to my child and stop eating meat because of that, it was different from seeing the torture that these animals go through, and I would never eat meat again. And I'm not like, I'm not that kind of judgmental guy where, like, oh my gosh, you kid, you know, I live my life and I make choices for myself. But I think veganism is so important. I do, because just like our own children, all these animals have a right to live a life not in fear of dying. And that's just it, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, it's so true in this country as well as in Asia, which brings up, particularly considering how difficult it is to do the work that you're doing, why are you focusing on what's going in Asia? Why not focus on what's going on right here in this country, which is horrible enough?
Oh, so first of all, you know, a lot of people wonder, like, why does he just rescue dogs? Recently, I pushed into other things. I did a chicken rescue. I helped this great group, Toronto Pig Save. I actually just went undercover into a pig slaughterhouse in Texas. You know, to document stuff for other groups so they can use to raise awareness, you know. But I focus on dogs because I have a dog foundation, you see. But not only that, I focus on dogs because I think rescue is a concept from beginning to end, where if you save an animal, you have to have and then plan for it. You know, if I save 300 cows, I wouldn't really know where to take them after. We are focusing on other animals because dogs are not special. And we're all special, you know, and that's something that I think needs to change. I think people, if you're an avid dog lover, I think you should bear witness to how bacon is made and the torture these pigs go through. I think you should see what these chickens go through. I think you should see a cow being slaughtered because they're just as great as who we are, who they are, and so...
Yeah, I think that a lot of us... I mean, I certainly was a person for whom a dog was my gateway animal. I mean, nothing... Unlike Gumby, nothing bad had happened to him. But I just loved him so much, and it made me start to see him. And then somehow I started to see other animals as well. And how do you deal with that question? Because, I mean, I'm not special, but somehow I did start to see other animals. And how do you talk to people who do care deeply about dogs and perhaps about their own dog, but just aren't vegan and aren't thinking about it?
Well, I want to say this. You know, before I became vegan, I didn't like that real aggressive vegan approach where people are shouting at your face or saying, you know, you bacon eater or just stuff like that. I always thought that caused an issue to where people didn't want to be vegan. I am more about subtle education to where, you know, a lot of people have become vegan through our movement, especially knowing that I'm vegan and like, I write these things, like I really write for myself. Sometimes it doesn't even make sense, but I write these things about animals, especially the dogs I rescue. And I talk about life and I try to relate it to all life, you know, because all life does matter. But I think even if people are passionate about dogs and care so much that they're willing to sacrifice who they are for a species, I think that's where veganism begins. And I really do believe, maybe not all of them, and maybe even only a small portion, but I believe a lot of them, or I'd like to believe, will understand what we've all come to understand in time. You know, some people are cold turkey. You know, I was cold turkey. You know, some people are not. You know, some people, they have to learn in steps.
Well, I totally agree that the kind of work you're doing and just the fact the people know you're vegan has got to influence those people in starting to think and start taking those steps. I know people listening are going to be really wanting to support you and wanting to find out more about your work. If someone can't adopt one of your dogs, how else can they support you?
You know, what I tell people is that for what we do, all groups are different, but for what we do, awareness is the most important thing. You know, to share our stories or to, like, get involved, even doing something like, you know, there's this bill that we have coming out in America that prohibits the eating of a dog and cat in all states because it's legal in 44. And I know we're going to take a lot of attacks from vegans, but for our movement and what we're doing in Asia, it matters. It matters because if our country cannot set the precedent, why should another country follow suit? And so, you know, supporting something like that. But also, too, if we're able to ever get a few animals federally banned from being eaten, it might in the future open the way up for a duck or a rabbit or, like, you know, who knows. And so, like I said, we all learn in different stages, and America is learning, you know. And there's a huge push towards compassion and towards veganism. And I think, it, you know, every day people see the light. And so if they can't support us, they can support someone like you. They can support... There's so many great groups out there doing great things. And so I just think that being proactive, you should get involved one way or somehow with something.
Well, that's for sure. Where can people find you online?
Well, we have a website, but the best thing is to follow us on like Facebook or Instagram because it's the most up-to-date stuff that we do. And so it's Animal Hope and Wellness at Facebook and Animal Hope and Wellness on Instagram.
Okay, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be finding you. This is an incredibly moving interview, Mark. Thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you so much for having saved all of those dogs. It's really, really very moving work that you're doing. And as I said, I think it's pretty clear that you have to find better ways to take care of yourself, because I want you to be doing this for a very long time.
Well, thanks. And thanks for having me.
Please like us. Check us out on social media and like, follow, do whatever you need to do to keep us on your radar. On Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, we are at Our Hen House, all one word. Also, you can find us online at ourhenhouse.org. And if you want to get in touch with us, or if you have any questions, or if you have any quandaries that you want us to consider addressing on the air, you can email us at info@ourhenhouse.org.
And now let's get right into some news. I've already covered the election news, the fact that the ballot initiative in Massachusetts won and the ballot initiative in Oklahoma lost, both by large margins, in Massachusetts by an enormous margin in the 70s, and both really good news for animals. So I won't talk about that again, even though I just did. You know, the good news doesn't come that often. We got to talk about it. But I'm going to cover some other news stories that don't have anything to do with the election. I know that's hard to believe. And one of them is about chickens. And this is from A Humane Nation, which is Wayne Pacelli's blog at HSUS. Breaking news, world's largest food service companies make historic animal welfare announcement. This animal welfare announcement is about chickens raised for meat, and there has been talk that this was going to be the next project of the animal protection movement in trying to get corporations to come on board, to make animals' lives a little less miserable. And we've seen the progress that these campaigns have made with the gestation crate and the battery cage. And now they are moving on to some of the horrors that chickens raised for meat experience. And this is a little, it's more difficult. There's no doubt about it. It's not as cut and dried as should they be in a cage or not in a cage. A pretty easy thing to measure. Because these chickens raised for meat who suffer horrifically, suffer in ways that are not as easy to just obviously identify. And so this is very, very quick progress in these campaigns. Of course, these are only tiny steps. I'm not denying it. But still, the fact that they only announced these campaigns really not that long ago, and they're already seeing these kinds of successes, shows that there's a lot of difference in these campaigns and the campaigns that have come before. So the two food service companies are Compass Group and Aramark, which are two of the top three largest food service companies. They run dining halls at colleges, universities, hospitals, stadiums, and they have basically set forth four principles that they're going to address four concerns for these chickens. They're going to transition to healthier strains of birds that measurably improve welfare issues associated with fast growth rates. These birds, of course, have been bred to grow enormously fast, enormously quickly, and that means that they suffer enormously because their bodies aren't made to withstand this kind of growth. It's just horrifying. They've turned chickens into their own cages. Reducing maximum stocking density to equal to or less than 6 pounds per square foot. That is still completely inadequate, of course, but you know, that's what we're looking at, improvements that are inadequate. Providing chickens with enriched environments, including natural light, hay bales, and perches. And rendering chickens unconscious prior to shackling using controlled or low atmosphere stunning. This is widely considered the best way to render birds unconscious before they're hung up by their feet they're now hung up by their feet and then their heads are run through electrified baths, and there is a lot of controversy whether that even renders them unconscious or whether it merely paralyzes them, making slaughter easy. I know this is all horrible to hear. It's all horrible. It's all horrifying. But, you know, this is the world we live in, and improvements are improvements. And it's important for us, no matter how we feel about them, to keep track of them. Compass Group, these are big companies, 10 million meals a day in the United States. They're going to do certification, which, as I mentioned, is harder in this kind of situation than it is in, you know, a battery cage situation, which is pretty obvious whether a farm is using battery cages or not. Oh, I use the word farm. I truly try not to use the word farm to talk about these, like, horrifying operations. But anyway, they're going to partner with Global Animal Partnership, which used to be connected to Whole Foods but is no longer, which is going to do the certification. There has, of course, been some criticism of whether they do adequate certification, but, you know, at least it's a start. Aramark is not using the GAP program, so unclear how they will be proving to anybody that they're actually doing this. But in spite of the 10 billion caveats I just talked about, this is really good news. Our next news is just on such a different front, but also very good news. Chimpanzees have rights, says Argentine judge as she orders Cecilia be released from zoo. This is from The Independent. And this is it's the equivalent of what in the United States would be a habeas corpus type of case. This judge in Argentina ruled that this chimpanzee who is living in a horrible zoo, and she's lived for years in a secluded cage, has ruled that she has legal rights and she should be released from the zoo into a sanctuary. And the decision, a quote from the judges, "We're not talking about civil rights enshrined in the civil code. We're talking about the species' own rights, development and life in their natural habitat." So we're really talking about fundamental rights here. And whatever we're talking about, apparently Cecilia is going to get out of the Mendoza Zoo, which is just a horror show, and into a sanctuary. So, you know, that's pretty good news. More good news. Isn't this good after the election? Depending on, of course, on how you feel about the election. Penguins and whales protected in world's largest park. This is from Franimals. The world's largest marine park has been created in the Ross Sea in the Southern Ocean in Antarctica, and it will now be the largest marine park. This is a result of an international agreement, and there are many, many animals living in there, including one-third of the world's Adélie penguins, a quarter of all emperor penguins, a third of all Antarctic petrels. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to Antarctica. And, you know, I'm worried that everything's going to disappear completely. But for the moment, 24 countries in the European Union have made an agreement and they want to save it. So that's nice to hear. It really is. And let's hope that these animals have years. The agreement is to last for 35 years. Let's hope that they have these years of living their lives in beauty and peace. Finally, another article from a Humane Nation from Wayne Pacelli. Breaking news: Taiwan votes to end cosmetics animal testing. This is great news from Taiwan, and it's the second major market in Southeast Asia to take a stand and on animal testing. And this puts Taiwan into accord with many, many countries, including the entire European Union. The other Asian country is South Korea, and it's just growing. And, you know, it will have to reach China, and that's really the market that is really causing all of the problems here. And once it does, I think things will, even though, of course, in the United States, we're behind the times, I don't think we're the real stumbling block because we don't require animal testing. And so this is great news. This is really global news. The animal testing for cosmetics is going to end, and this is one more big step in that direction. So I gave you some good news, and I hope you appreciate it because it was hard for me to gather the will to look at things that made me feel better in any way. So I did, and I feel I'm glad I did it. And that is it for this week's news.
Our hen house has a flock, and we'd love you to be in it.
A one-time donation of $150 or more makes you a flock member for a year, or you can sign up for a month-to-month membership for $15 a month. We will not only send you a Change the World for Animals sticker, but you will have access to our flock-only Facebook group, where you'll get the inside scoop from the Our Hen House coop. Are we overdoing the hen analogies? Cluck no. And more important, this is where flock members squawk about everything from their favorite books to their latest encounter with hostile meat eaters. There's nothing like community to make you feel a little more at home in a sometimes pretty difficult world.
Hi, everybody. This is Jasmine Singer, and I am really glad that you're joining us today. I'm really thrilled about today's interview that I have with Zinc's founder and creative director, Ben Friedland. Now, this is an interview that I haven't done too many interviews like this, but this guy has veganized his business, and he did it for reasons that I think you're going to be as excited about as I am. And it is a business in the fashion realm, so the fact that these shifts are being made by fashion gurus and entrepreneurs, and it's based in the same ethical force that drives many of us, is nothing short of emboldening and hopeful, especially as we now get into a time of year that is difficult for many of us. And I latch onto hope in any way, shape, or form that I can, and I think that this is the perfect thing to latch on to. So I think you'll be as excited as I am when you hear about all of the work that Ben Friedland is doing with Zinc. Welcome to our Hen House, Ben.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
I'm excited too. This is something that we haven't really tackled before. It's your company that has recently made some huge changes, and gosh, there's so many things to unpack here, but let's just start with what Zinc is. What is Zinc? How did it get started?
So I had worked in New York for over 10 years in fashion. And so one day I had decided, you know what? I want to start my own business. I didn't know what that business would be, but my main goal with the business was to produce or, you know, design something of very high quality. Because I named my brand after my grandfather, Zinc, who is a award-winning Nantucket basket weaver, I just wanted to make sure whatever I did do in terms of the business lived up to his standards of quality and craftsmanship.
And what kind of products are, what kind of business is it? What kind of products are you producing?
So Zinc is a lifestyle accessory brand, and we used to be an exotic skin and leather accessory brand, but we recently transitioned to a vegan, 100% vegan lifestyle brand with fair trade and sustainable elements within the collection.
That is awesome. I'm so excited to hear it.
I'm excited too, because for so long I was trying to figure out how to become vegan, but for so long I had always thought vegan products were made with maybe a lower quality material or maybe a material that wasn't good for the environment. So I'm excited to be able to now produce and design something that is vegan, but also using very high quality materials and fabrics and trimming.
Well, that's what I think is so great. In addition to the fact that you're no longer exploiting anybody in the process of making this product, you're aiming to help way more than just animals, right?
Oh, totally. So I'm really excited because as I was, you know, processing the transition of going to the vegan brand, I fell upon an amazing organization that teaches women in South Asia how to weave jute and also gives them the ability to live a self-reliant life and empowers them. So not only are we vegan, but we have fair trade elements within the collection, and the jute collection really, really helps a tremendous amount of women in South Asia, which is to me, not only is it a high-quality, handmade product, but it's also helping this big group of women, which is wonderful.
Oh, my God, so good. Yeah, and I was recently speaking on a panel, and someone asked, you know, I don't even know where to start with how to get involved with changing the world for animals. And, you know, the answer is, of course, well, what are you good at and what do you love to do? Start there. And what I think is refreshing about what you're doing with Zinc is that you are using fashion as a way to change the world for animals, but also bringing in so many other important issues. And it's just a really positive way of affecting change and opening eyes. Because fashion seems to be leaning more toward veganism than ever before, or is that just me being overly optimistic?
You know, I think that the younger generation sees fashion and actual business different than the older generations. I think that they want to make sure when they hand over their money that the organization that they're giving the money to has the same beliefs and practices as they do. It's not like my generation where it was very logo driven. It didn't matter. No one even had on their radar what was this made of? How are the animals treated? How are the employees? How are the work staff treated? You know, what is the material doing for the environment? And I think because the younger generation, it really has inspired the older generation, especially with fashion, because I think fashion has become so disposable now that all of a sudden people are realizing they have all this junk that not only hurt animals, but also has hurt the environment and also is not living up to the proper standards of employment of how, you know, employees are treated who are making the product.
I was reading about your company, and I'm curious what plant cashmere is.
So, you know, vegans won't use anything from animals. They don't even, you know, maybe use honey. So when we used to make shawls, you know, out of cashmere and wool, I tried to source something that was, you know, vegan friendly, and I started working with this supplier that does plant cashmere. So what it is it feels as fine, it feels as fine as cashmere, but it's actually cotton that is woven to feel like cashmere. It's very light. It's 100% natural. And within our plant cashmere, we only use natural dyes or azo-free dyes so that they're good for the environment. So what's great about the cotton is that since it's natural, you'll never feel too hot with it or too cold with it. It's just a wonderful, snuggly kind of material. So
and cork as well, because you describe cork as a perfect vegan alternative to leather. So that, is that more of a thicker kind of material?
It is. And the thing about cork is that it's sustainably harvested. And so cork trees regenerate after a few many years. So what you're doing is you're getting the cork, but eventually the tree regrows the cork. And the cork is nice because it's lightweight. It's obviously water resistant naturally just because, you know, they use it for cork bottles and stuff, and then it's a tree. So it's a great alternative to real leather. And it's durable as well. And it also takes color very, very well.
There's a couple things you talked about that I want to circle back around to. I feel like I got so excited about the fact that you transitioned your company to vegan as part of your ethos of sustainability and compassion. And I just want to go back to that moment. Like, what was that like for you? Because that feels to me like that would be a major, major shift for a company.
You know, it has been a major shift, and it has not been easy. But for the first all, I really believe in it. So when you believe something so passionately, it's amazing how many doors open for you. It's been quite the transition. What happened to me was one day I woke up, and when I first started Zinc, I had thought I want to be a quality luxury brand. And the first thing that came to my mind was exotic skins and fine leather. People immediately think, you know, luxury, high quality, as soon as they see those materials. And so as time went on, and one day, you know, I'm sitting with my interns who are all in their, you know, their 19, 20, 21, and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I had this thought, wait a minute, this generation isn't interested in exotics. They're not interested in leather. They want something that is good for the environment, that the workers are getting fair, you know, compensation for. And one day I just woke up and said, it's time for us to make a real push and believe in passionately about becoming vegan and making sure that the product that we're producing is good for the environment. And on top of that, that the workers who are making it are getting just as much of a, kind of compensation for that we are. You know, a lot of times the actual person who's making the money is the company, and the workers are being exploited, and they're making all this fabulous high-end product, and they're living a tent or in bad conditions or working in bad conditions. So it just came to me as a natural to realize that this is not something that Zinc believes in, and it's time for us to make the change.
Well, I just think that is amazing that you had that kind of awakening that I think everyone probably listening to this hopes that the big companies start to connect those dots as well. And I know that, you know, there's other people in your industry who have started to make those connections, but you're showing that it's not only based in like actual goodness and common sense, but in a business know-how, because this is an industry that especially the younger generation really cares more about its sustainability in the long run. I think that the younger generation is a lot smarter than us, for sure. I guess what I want to know more about, too, is if you could talk more about jute and the ways that you are more specifically helping human animals as well.
Well, the jute is sustainable. It's natural. In South Asia, jute is a big industry. Jute is very, very durable. Jute, you know, I think in the past, people always thought of jute as rough and tough. We do some beautiful jute that looks not only, you know, when people see the prices of the bags and the quality of the bags, because the jute collection ranges from $30 up to $98, they're always shocked by how beautifully it's made, how beautiful it feels. It's not the rough, tough jute that people imagine in their heads. And we also use a cotton interior that is organic, it's sustainable, it's unrefined cotton, no chemical additives or anything like that. And also what is great about the organization I work with, not only do they help the women artisans, and when I say help the women artisans, the factory where they work is light, airy, it's, you know, they have good amazing working conditions. There is a child daycare center within the facility so that the women don't have to worry about what they're dealing with their children. They can go to work. These women often have gone through, you know, challenging situations. They offer psychology help. There's lots of things, but also in regards to the farmers we work with, the organization we partner with also gives the farmers clear prices. They make sure that they supply the farmers with the best seeds. They make sure that it's sustainable. So not only are the women who are actually weaving the jute bags for us and dyeing the jute bags for us receive awesome things, so does the farmers. And this helps about 4,000 families within South Asia, not only the women artisans, but also the families of the farmers. So it's a great thing because I think from seed to the end product, the farmers to the weavers to me, we're all getting something that's great, and we're all making sure that everybody is getting the proper support and the proper needs, and that we're all one big family, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What's next for Zinc? What are your plans for the future?
So for Zinc, we're just about to introduce bags. We're working with a very, very small family-run. They don't even call it a factory. They call it a laboratory in Italy. And we're introducing for holiday bags made of cork in a vegan leather. And the vegan leather is not polyurethane. It's a mixture of it has some polyurethane in it, but it's mostly recycled materials. We're also launching bags in the spring made out of pineapple fibers. And we're also launching in spring bags made out of wood pulp. So I also think that a lot of times people think that vegan materials are cheap materials. But to be honest, many of the vegan materials are more pricey than actual real leather.
That is so good. It's more, it lasts longer, right?
It lasts longer, and a lot of it has sustainable properties. A lot of it, you know, is biodegradable. You know, there's a lot of things where, you know, materials that are vegan end up sitting in a landfill and they don't break down. You know, in the terms of when we use cotton and we use linen, of course they're natural, but a lot of man-made fabrics, you know, are polyester or acetate, and they don't break down in landfills like the natural fibers do.
Well, I'm very excited about your company, and I don't even pay attention that often to, you know, just bag companies and accessory companies. And when I hear about something like this, I wonder if I should pay attention more often, because this is completely thrilling to me. And I was looking around at your website, and I think I found approximately 12 things that I would like. So can you just tell us what the website is for our listeners who want to check you out?
Of course. It's Zink, Z-I-N-K, everyday.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for all you're doing to change the world for animals and human animals as well. And you inspire us, and you really make me really believe that entrepreneurship can be an important avenue for activism. So thanks for joining us today in our Hen House.
Well, thank you for having me, and organizations like you make me proud to be doing what I'm doing.
Well, that was Ben Friedland. Love that guy. Love that story. Love that interview. And as I mentioned, I'm Jasmine Singer, so you can look at my book, Always Too Much and Never Enough, over at my website, jasminesinger.com. There's no E on Jasmine, and it is a memoir that talks about the ways that I was betrayed by the food industry, and in particular factory farming, and how as I started to pull that apart, I found the many ways that I was betraying myself. So I think there will be pieces of my story that will speak to you and will weave in with your own story. So if you like it, then please leave a friendly review. And if you don't like it, don't say anything. Anyway, you could email me at info@jasminesinger.com, no E on Jasmine. And you could find me on social media at @jasminesingerauthor on Instagram. On Twitter, I'm @jasmine_singer. And on Facebook, just look for my name, Jasmine Singer, and you'll find me there. That's it from me. I'm going to hand it back to Marianne. I look forward to chatting with you next week. We have so many great interviews coming up, by the way. Oh my God. It's so good. It's so good. If you love the Our Hen House podcast, we're hoping that you will take advantage of a huge opportunity to help us out. From now until the end of the year, a very generous group of Our Hen House supporters, a group whom we affectionately call our Barnyard Benefactors, have gotten together and agreed to match every donation, dollar for dollar, if we can raise $25,000 from our listeners by the end of the year. This is a huge opportunity for us. It's also quite a stretch. If you value the Our Hen House family of podcasts, this one, the Animal Law podcast, and the Teaching Jasmine How to Cook Vegan podcast, and if you want to see them grow, and most of all, if you want to help us to reach more and more people who want to change the world for animals and need a little help, this is an enormous opportunity to give us the help that we need. You know, only a tiny percentage of the people who listen to Our Hen House every week are helping us by becoming flock members. If you're one of the ones who hasn't yet contributed, I think you can agree that this is the time to change that. If you think I'm right, just go right to ourhenhouse.org and click on the donate button. To everyone who is already supporting the podcast, thank you, thank you, thank you. Seriously, you are our lifeblood. We literally could not do this without you. If it's within your means, anything extra at this crucial time is deeply appreciated. I can't tell you how much we appreciate and love you. We adore you. We love you. We adore you. We love you. Can I say it enough times? No, I can't. If you're already giving what you can afford, again, thank you from the bottom of our hen hearts, and continue to spread the word about our show. Again, just go to ourhenhouse.org and click on the donate button. And thank you. We adore you. We love you. Thank you. Anxieties are rising. Yes, they are. It's not really an article, it's a video accompanied by a short article. It's pretty disturbing. I don't like it at all. The Comeback. It's from a website called The Comeback. And it's a video featuring this woman, Stephanie Patakis. She apparently works at The Onion, which is annoying because I like The Onion. Now I don't, at least for a while. And she does casting for The Onion. And, all right, so this is the title. Vegetarian eats meat for first time in 22 years, and reaction is glorious. And so the whole video is this woman who went vegetarian. No, it's not vegan. Vegetarian. 22 years ago when she was in school, she was in fourth grade, in order to help save the planet. And now, for reasons which remain completely unexplained, she's sitting down at this steakhouse and eating meat.
and they're videoing her doing it. And it is the stupidest friggin' thing. I mean, it's not even fun. There's nothing about it. There's nothing. It's not funny. It's not intelligent. It's just her eating meat. And first she takes a bite of, she delivers her lines as if they're funny, but they're not. And she takes some chicken and has to say about it, "That's real good skin." That sounds kind of weird to say. After that, they cut. There's an obvious cut in the video, and one wonders whether they took out something that indicated that she might have been a little bit dismayed to be eating a chicken. And then she tries some bone marrow. She's been dying to try bone marrow, apparently, because, as she says, it seems like the weirdest part of the animal to eat, and she just loves it, and she goes on and on about how much she loves it. And she says, "I was like, no, animals, you can't hurt them. Then I'm like, I'm going to suck this out of your bone." As if that's funny. Do these people not realize that almost everybody eats meat? This is not a transgressive behavior. This is not joining a club, an exclusive club. This is just doing what everybody else does. No explanation of why she has stopped caring about animals, or why she stopped caring about the planet. Nothing. Just that she's enjoying eating this meat. And as she says, it's a whole different level of food that I was not aware existed out there. What? She wasn't aware that meat existed and that people liked it? And now she's so happy to be a part of this. A part of this, again, as if it's this exclusive group that's... It's everybody, folks. Everybody eats meat. It's not unusual. So she thanks the chef at the end and she says, "I'm going to eat meat until the day I die, which might be later tonight," which I think was some kind of like joke about her anxiety about maybe this wasn't a good thing to do, at least for her, but nothing about any of the reasons. This is so gross. And it's a little article that accompanies it says, "So go out and be proud to be a meat eater today, because even a vegetarian has seen the light." I mean, what light? She tasted it and she thought it tasted good. That's not light. That's darkness, if you ask me. Now, our next two articles are from Meeting Place, one of my favorite sources for anxiety. And boy, they have a lot of it out there. And the first article is from Gregory Bloom. It's a column. He has a column called The Meat Business. And this particular entry in the column is called Why FSIS Shouldn't Continue Verifying Animal Raising Claims. And apparently, FSIS, which is the Food Safety and Inspection Service at the USDA, basically they inspect slaughterhouses, the division of USDA that inspects slaughterhouses, and they've recently announced that they're seeking public comments whether they should continue the practice of verifying animal raising claims. And they don't do a whole lot of verifying of animal raising claims. They only verify certain claims. But anyway, that's not what this is about. Now, Gregory goes on to say, well, no, they shouldn't continue this because they do such a terrible job at it. And there's just no way that we can rely on them to do a good job. All they do is use a piece of paper. They just ask, when he worked in the business, it amazed him that all it took for the FSIS to allow us to process a load of organic or never ever beef carcasses was an affidavit we received via fax. So he's saying they don't actually verify. It's ridiculous for them to continue this program because they're not doing anything. They're just asking for a piece of paper. They don't go on farm and see how the animals are raised. So that's interesting. You know, that's the kind of thing that we would say, only we might not say that they shouldn't do it. We would say that they should do a better job at it. And so he has reasons why FSIS should not be in this business. They don't have functional infrastructure. Well, they could fix that. They would just have to get some money to build it. It would cause unproductive red tape. Well, all regulation, I mean, that's what regulations are and verifications are. And really what he's saying is that they don't have enough red tape. And they're, I mean, if you look at what he's saying, it kind of means there should be more. But he's saying that would be unproductive red tape because they wouldn't do a good job at it. And then his final reason, and this might be a big one. Animal rights groups are ready to swoop in and opportunistically pounce on these claims to pile up further hurdles on animal producers. And so if SIS continues to do that, it is true that, as he says, the devilishly sneaky HSUS and other animal rights groups will continue devilishly sneaky. Don't you just love that? Will continue to try to extinguish our industry through expanding federal inspection systems. So he starts off by saying that they shouldn't be doing it because they're doing such a lousy job. And then he's saying, but if they do a better job, they'll be destroying our industry because they'll be regulating it. Of course, he thinks the industry should do it itself. If these third-party verification claims aren't any good, the government doing it isn't any good, the industry should do it itself. But the reason that HSUS doesn't want that to happen is because, quote, they clearly have an agenda to regulate us to death. Well, you know, from your lips, Gregory, or from your pen, or from your computer. All right, our second column at Meeting Place is the column called Meet Your Markets, M-E. They love to use the term. The word meet, M-E-E-T, but spell it M-E-A-T, over at Meeting Place, which, of course, that's the name of the website as well, as I've pointed out many times, but it just never fails to amuse me. Meeting Place. This article is by one Matt Graves. And, again, about HSUS. HSUS is driving the industry crazy. The title of this article, Beef Sandwiches for Lunch at HSUS HQ. Well, that's something that certainly I noticed. I was like, they're serving beef sandwiches at HSUS? Well, that's disturbing. Let me read this article. But that's not exactly what's going on here. What he's talking about is a meeting that was held a few years ago when he was asked to serve on the board of a fledgling animal welfare nonprofit. And I don't know what organization this was because he doesn't name it, but it had the goal of establishing humane animal handling guidelines for food animals. And it was a very small organization, and at the time, HSUS was flirting with doing some business because, you know, HSUS does operate in that realm from time to time of establishing humane animal handling, quote-unquote, humane animal handling guidelines. And so somehow it got suggested that the meeting for these groups of coming together should be at HSUS headquarters. And so they said fine. And as he said, that was their first mistake. And he said right after the meeting, this new animal quote-unquote welfare organization was just shut out by HSUS. They can't use the offices anymore, and ultimately they stopped doing business with them at all. And he says, this is a quote, being a curious sort, I asked why. I was told that it was probably because of someone ordering beef sandwiches that were brought into the HSUS offices to be consumed there. The powers that be at HSUS were quite upset. I suspect they were livid. Now, actually, I mean, he doesn't say who he asked and whether this was really the reason. It seems like it probably wasn't. And he confesses that he was the culprit that ordered and consumed the beef sandwiches. And, you know, he felt bad at the time. But now, in hindsight, however, I have derived a perverse pleasure from consuming beef in the offices of an organization who has one of its stated purposes that reduction in consumption of animal protein. Just think of the consternation of the HSUS folks when they found out someone using their offices had the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to consume beef there. Oh, the shame. Like, really? he's going so far to get any pleasure out of offending HSUS, which we don't even know whether that really happened or whether anybody even noticed he was eating his dead animal sandwiches. But he loves the idea that he was the problem and that it drove everybody at HSUS crazy. Does he not know that, you know, people at HSUS, as much as they might wish that people don't eat beef, are pretty aware that people do all the time. But anyway, so he uses this as an example to show that animal welfare groups and the meat and poultry industry can exist symbiotically, but animal rights groups with the stridency of HSUS. I mean, does he really think that HSUS is the strident one? Are marching at cross purposes with both animal welfare and food animal protein businesses. Okay. So, you know, he's basically saying we can't do business with people who don't want people to eat animals. So we just hate them, and they're undermining us, and that's that. And you know what? That's probably true. Though there have been an awful lot of deals going on that indicate that it's actually not true. So who knows? And he goes on to say, we inside the meat and poultry industry must adopt similar tactics to what HSUS, PETA, and the rest of them use against us. Don't you love that line? Don't you just love it? They're looking to HSUS and PETA and saying, we have to do what they're doing. You know why? Because they know that we're winning. And he goes on to say, you might shy away from the stridency I am suggesting, but I have come to believe, just listen to this line, I have come to believe we are losing the meat consumption war, and it is a war to those AR groups, especially with the millennials and younger current and potential meat consumers. Well, yeah, you are. I love that. Anxieties are rising out there.
Did you know that our hen house publishes ebooks? Hen Press's latest is Maureen by Anat Pick. This complex and beautiful essay has something truly new to say about how we treat the vulnerable among us, whether they are the frail elderly hidden away in nursing homes or the animals who end up on our plates. Also, you've probably heard by now about the raging controversy regarding the Liberian chimpanzees abandoned to starve by the New York Blood Center. If you want the truly unbelievable backstory on those chimps, a tale of quote-unquote love, betrayal, civil war, and so much more, don't miss The Lines We Draw by Sangu Iyer. Hen Press's books are available wherever ebooks are sold, or go to ourhenhouse.org and click on Hen Press to find out more.
Well, that's it for this week's show. I hope it helped inspire you to do everything you can to change the world for animals. And remember, now is a great time to donate to our hen house because of the matching fund that's going on. So if you would like to and are able to, and we would really, really appreciate it, please go to ourhenhouse.com/donate. And as always, if you are a member of the flock, thank you so much. We cannot tell you how much it means to us and how we would not really be able to do this at all without your support. We'll be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to download us. And in the meantime, please don't give in to despair. Keep doing what you do to change the world for animals. Right now, more than ever, please don't forget that you really are all that they've got.